A Daughter Saturn by Clark Ashton Smith. When Morgai, the high priest of the goddess Yaounde, together with 12 of his most ferocious and efficient underlings, came at morning twilight to seek the infamous heretic Ibon in his house of black gneiss on a headland above the northern main, they were surprised as well as disappointed to find him absent. Their surprise was due to the fact that they had every intention of taking him unawares, for all their plots against Ibon had been carried on with meticulous privacy in underground vaults with soundproof bolted doors, and they themselves had made the long journey to his house in a single night, immediately following the hour of his condemnation. They were disappointed because the formidable writ of arrest, with symbolic flame-etched runes on a scroll of human skin, was now useless, and because there seemed to be no early prospect of trying out the ingenious agonies, the intricately harrowing ordeals which they had devised for Ibon with such care. Morgai was especially disappointed, and the malisons which he muttered when the emptiness of the topmost room had revealed itself were of truly cabalistic length and fearfulness. Ibon was his chief rival in wizardry, and was acquiring altogether too much fame and prestige among the peoples of Muthulan, that ultimate peninsula of the Hyperborean continent. So, Morgai had been glad to believe certain malignant rumours concerning Ibon, and to utilise them in the charges he had preferred. These rumours were that Ibon was the devotee of the long-discredited heathen god Zothakwa, whose worship was incalculably older than man, and that Ibon's magic was drawn from his unlawful affiliation with this dark deity, who had come down by way of other worlds from a foreign universe, in primeval times when the earth was still no more than a steaming morass. The power of Zothakwa was still feared, and it was said that those who were willing to forego their humanity by serving him would become the heritors of anti-mundane secrets, and the masters of a knowledge so awful that it could only have been brought from outlying planets coeval with night and chaos. The house of Ibon was built in the form of a pentagonal tower, and possessed 5 stories, including the 2 that were underground. All, of course, had been searched with painstaking thoroughness, and the 3 servants of Ibon had been tortured with a slow drip of boiling hot asphaltum to make them reveal their master's whereabouts. Their continued denial of all knowledge, after a half hour of this, was taken as proof that they were genuinely ignorant. No sign of a subterranean passage was unearthed by delving in the walls and floor of the lower rooms, though Morgai had even gone so far as to remove the flagstones beneath an obscene image of Zothakwa which occupied the nethermost. This he had done with extreme reluctance, for the squat, fur-covered god with his bat-like features and sloth-like body was fearsomely abhorrent to the high priest of the elk goddess Yaounde. Returning in renewed search to the highest room of Ibon's tower, the inquisitors were compelled to own themselves baffled. There was nothing to be found but a few articles of furniture, some antique volumes on conjuration such as might be owned by any sorcerer, some disagreeable and gruesome paintings on rolls of pterodactyl parchment, and certain primitive urns and sculptures and totem poles of the sort that Ibon had been so fond of collecting. Zothakwa, in one form or another, was represented in most of these, his face even leered with a bestial somnolence from the urn handles, and he was to be found in half the totems, which were those of subhuman tribes, along with the seal, the mammoth, the giant tiger, and the aurochs. Morgai felt that the charges against Ibon were now substantiated beyond all remaining doubt, for surely no one who was not a worshipper of Zothakwa would care to own even a single representation of this loathsome entity. However, such additional evidence of guilt, no matter how significant or damnatory, was of small help in finding Ibon. Staring from the windows of the topmost chamber, where the walls fell sheer to the cliff, and the cliff dropped clear on two sides to a raging sea 400 feet below, Morgai was driven to credit his rival with superior resources of magic. Otherwise, the man's disappearance was altogether too much of a mystery. And Morgai had no love for mysteries, unless they were part of his own stock in trade. He turned from the window and re-examined the room with minutely careful attention. Ibon had manifestly used it as a sort of study. There was a writing table of ivory with reed pens and various coloured inks in little earthen pots, and there were sheets of paper made from a kind of calamite, all scribbled over with odd astronomical and astrological calculations that caused Morgai to frown because he could not understand them. On each of the five walls there hung one of the parchment paintings, all of which seemed to be the work of some aboriginal race. Their themes were blasphemous and repellent, and Xothaqua figured in all of them, amid forms and landscapes whose abnormality and sheer uncouthness may have been due to the half-developed technique of the primitive artists. Morgai now tore them from the walls, one by one, as if he suspected that Ibon might in some manner be concealed behind them. The walls were now entirely bare, and Morgai considered them for a long time amid the respectful silence of his underlings. A queer panel high up in the southeastern side above the writing table had been revealed by the removal of one of the paintings. Morgai's heavy brows met in a long black bar as he eyed this panel. It was conspicuously different from the rest of the wall, being an oval-shaped inlay of some reddish metal that was neither gold nor copper, a metal that displayed an obscure and fleeting fluorescence of rare colours when one peered at it through half-shut eyelids. But somehow it was impossible, with open eyes, even to remember the colours of this fluorescence. Morgai, who, perhaps, was cleverer and more perspicacious than Ibon had given him credit for being, conceived a suspicion that was apparently baseless and absurd, since the wall containing the panel was the outer wall of the building and could give only on the sky and sea. He climbed upon the writing table and struck the panel with his fist. The sensations which he felt and the result of the blow were alike astounding. A sense of icy cold, so extreme that it was hardly distinguishable from extreme heat, ran along his hand and arm through his whole body as he smote the unknown reddish metal. And the panel itself swung easily outward, as if on unseen hinges, with a high, sonorous clang that seemed to fall from an incomputable distance. Beyond it, Morgai saw that there was neither sky nor sea, nor, in fact, anything he had ever seen or heard of, or even dreamed of in his most outrageous nightmares. He turned to his companions. The look on his face was half amazement, half triumph.
"Wait here till I return,"
he commanded, and leaped headlong through the open panel. The charges that had been brought against Ibon were indeed true. The sagacious wizard, in his lifelong study of laws and agencies, both natural and supernatural, had taken account of the myths that were prevalent in Muthulan regarding Zofakwa, and had thought it conceivably worthwhile to make a personal investigation of this obscure pre-human entity. He had cultivated the acquaintance of Zothakwa, who, in the desuetude of his worship, was now driven to lead an existence wholly subterranean. He had offered the prescribed prayers, had made the sacrifices that were most acceptable, and the strange, sleepy little god, in return for Ibon's interest and his devotion, had confided to him certain information that was more than useful in the practice of the black art. Also, he had presented Ibon with some autobiographical data that confirmed the popular legends in more explicit detail. For reasons which he did not specify, he had come to Earth in former eons from the planet Sikrinosh, the name by which Saturn was called in Muthulan, and Sikrinosh itself had been merely a way station in his travels from remoter worlds and systems. As a special reward, after years of service and burnt offerings, he presented to Ibon a large, thin, oval plate of some ultra-telluric metal, instructing him to have it fitted as a hinged panel in an upper room of his house. The panel, if swung outward from the wall on open air, would have the peculiar property of giving admittance to the world Sikrinosh, many million miles away in space. According to the vague and somewhat unsatisfactory explanation vouchsafed by the god, this panel, being partly wrought from a kind of matter which belonged to another universe than man's, possessed uncommon radiative properties that served to ally it with some higher dimension of space, through which the distance to astronomically remote spheres was a mere step. Zothakwa, however, warned Ibon not to make use of the panel unless in time of extreme need, as a means of escape from otherwise inevitable danger, for it would be difficult, if not impossible, to return to Earth from Sikrinosh, a world where Ibon might find it anything but easy to acclimate himself, since the conditions of life were very different from those in Muthulan, even though they did not involve so total an inversion of all terrene standards and norms as that which prevailed in the more outlying planets. Some of Zothakwa's relatives were still resident in Sikrinosh and were worshipped by its peoples, and Zothakwa told Ibon the almost unpronounceable name of the most powerful of these deities, saying that it would be useful to him as a sort of password if he should ever need to visit Sikrinosh. The idea of a panel that would open on some remote world impressed Ibon as being rather fantastic, not to say far-fetched. But he had found Zothakwa to be in all ways and at all times a most voracious deity. However, he made no trial of the panel's unique virtues, till Zothakwa, who maintained a close surveillance of all underground doings, had warned him of the machinations of Morgai and the processes of ecclesiastic law that were being instituted in the vaults below the temple of Yaounde. Knowing, as he did, the power of these jealous bigots, Ibon decided that it would be injudicious to the point of folly if he were to let himself fall into their hands. Bidding a short and grateful farewell to Zothakwa, and collecting a small parcel of bread and meat and wine, he retired to his study and climbed upon the writing table. Then, lifting aside the crude picture of a scene in Sikrinosh with which Zothakwa had inspired some primeval half-human artist, he pushed open the panel it had served to conceal. Ibon saw that Zothakwa was indeed a god of his word, for the scene beyond the panel was nothing that could ever find a legitimate place in the topography of Muthulan or of any terrestrial region. It did not altogether appeal to him, but there was no alternative save the inquisitorial cells of the goddess Yaounde. Envisaging in thought the various refinements and complications of torture which Morgai would have now prepared, he sprang through the opening into Sikrinosh with an agility that was quite juvenile for a wizard of mature years.